Welcome to another TMG interview. My name is Paul Preston, talking to someone I met recently at a screening of Ghostbusters. Now, I could talk to anyone about Ghostbusters, but today's guest was actually a script PA on that classic film. But a deeper dive reveals all manner of projects that we'll get into today, from Frank Chindamo.
Woohoo! How you doing? Hello, everybody.
Doing outstanding because, you know, we're having Ghostbusters talk. Twist my arm. So let's jump right into it.
All right.
You were a young pup when you worked on this film, right? The screening where I met you was in San Pedro, California. I was brought to provide my Ecto-1. I got a 2016 style Ecto-1 and some inflatables, a big Slimer statue in the lobby, and we were having all sorts of photo ops with that stuff. And I offered to do some pre-show trivia, and then you came up right after me, and I was like, who is this guy? And you had some great stories. So tell the story you told the crowd that night about your experience, which sounds like one of the more interesting ones on Ghostbusters.
Sure. Well, first let me grab the script here. So this is the original script from the movie, and I was the script PA. So my job was to make sure, I don't know if you can see this light, but my job was to make sure that all the actors who had speaking roles had the right pages on the right day. And because we had only typewriters in those days, then I would work with the script supervisor, who would then hand the pages to a typist, who would then show them to the writers, which were, of course, Dan Aykroyd and Harold Ramis, who would be off in a room somewhere. And then they would come out with changes, and then the changes would get made, and then the typist would go at it again. And my job was to take the original script from the typist and then Xerox them onto the right color paper. So I believe it was first revisions were in pink, second revisions were in blue, and third revisions were in marigold. And so that's what I've got here. You can see it's kind of falling apart, but that's what I've got here, are the original script with the original pages in it. My job was, you know, I was kind of like the last person in the production office at night, and then the first person on set in the morning, and I would take the pages and I would deliver them, knock on the doors of the trailer for Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd, Harold Ramis, and Rick Moranis, right? And so every morning I'd show up at their trailer, and so Moranis would look at the pages and go, yeah, that looks good. Yeah, that's okay. Yeah, okay, or I can do that. Yeah, sure, you know. Very friendly guy, real sweetheart. I once asked him, like, can I get you a cup of coffee? Oh, no, I can get it myself. Hey, no problem, eh? And just very, very humble guy. And then, you know, Ernie Hudson would look it over and just go, yeah, I got this. Yeah, no problem. Yeah. Right. And then Dan Aykroyd would do the same thing, you know. Oh, yes, right, yes, okay, good, this, yeah, good, right? And then Harold Ramis would look it over, and Ramis would be like, yeah, okay, all right, yeah, that's good, oh, that's good, all right, okay, good, yeah, right? And then I'd hand it to Bill Murray, and I'd go, you know, Mr. Murray, here's your script. I'd go, what is this? This is terrible. Who wrote this shit? Get this out of here, kid. And I would quake in my boots because I'm 19 years old, you know. And I would just quake in my boots and go like, oh, I'm really sorry, Mr. Murray. Oh, I'll get it back to you. Oh, I'm just kidding with you, kid. Don't worry about it. Come here. What's your name again? And he remembered my name, and he remembered everybody's name all the way through. And even when I worked with him again at SNL a couple of times, he remembered my name, and he was such a nice guy, Bill Murray. So they all were, and it was just such a pleasure to work with them.
Yeah. How did you get plucked to work on one of the most iconic comedies of all time?
Weirdest thing, I was a student at NYU, and I had went to the job board, and there was a job where I could work on a Channel J cable TV show about impact on hunger, about solving world hunger, right? And this is 1980 something. And so every week we'd have somebody on the show, and it was just like, you know, this really boring, boring thing with somebody, you know, talking about grain exports through the United Nations. Super boring. So boring, in fact, that they would, the cameramen themselves would literally fall asleep at the cameras. So the shot would go like, here's what the shot would look like. It would, right. This would look like. And the person would be talking, and then it would, when it got to about here, the director would look up from his coffee and go, oh, camera one, crane up, you know. So I would volunteer to do the camera on this. And I was really excited. And there's a big, giant, old TV studio cameras with the pedestals on them.
Oh, yeah.
They're massive. They're 1,000 pounds, right? And I'm this skinny little 135-pound kid. And I'm like really struggling to move them around. But I did somehow. And so they kept me on the show. And we had a guest on the show whose name was Sister Teresa something or other. And she was talking about how she was helping solve world hunger in India in her missions there. And when she showed us pictures of what she was doing, we were like, that's 1,000 people. You're feeding like thousands of people. How are you even doing this? And she told us about it. And we all kind of turned to each other and went like, this is a great idea for a documentary. We should do a documentary on this woman. And we did, and it was called The World of Mother Teresa. And so I literally got to work with a saint. How does this answer your question? Well, working on that movie gave me a little special edge over the dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of other people who had applied to be a production assistant on this movie, right? And so I said, well, I did work on SNL before this. And they said, oh, well, that's good. And the first AD looks at my resume and said, you worked with Mother Teresa? And I went, yeah. And he said, it'd be bad luck not to hire you. You're in.
Well, you mentioned SNL a couple times and at the event where we met. So I was going to ask what cast you were on, but it sounds like you worked with Bill. So it was like the heyday. And what were your duties there?
Oh, if only that were true. No, let me.
It was post. It was the what is it, the Downey years or the.
Here's that script. So it was the first post Chevy, post Bill, post Gilda year. It was 1980-81 season.
Post Lorne? Is he out by then too? Or?
It was Gene Demaney was the producer. Yeah. And my job was, this was actually predates Ghostbusters, but my job was like go over the scripts with the writers and at the table reads and that sort of a thing. And so here's a couple of the original scripts up there. And so my job there was to make sure that the writers in the cast and everybody had the correct script. So I was gifted a couple of these bound editions here.
Oh, that's cool.
And it was the year that Eddie Murphy joined the cast. It was Eddie Murphy, Denny Dillon, Joe Piscopo, Charlie Rocket.
Gary Kroger.
Paul Mathias, and Risley. All right. And so the guest host was Bill Murray.
Ah, okay. I see. Okay.
So Billy, as everybody called him. Billy, he taught me how to do a Walter Cronkite impersonation, which is fun.
This is Walter Cronkite with the CBS Evening News.
On that show, it was, there was an interesting scenario. And do I have time for one more story?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay, great. So the show is struggling. It's dying. It's just terrible. We're so bad. And so here they're letting this, you know, very young intern who was, you know, from a lower middle class background. And I had lied my way to get onto the show. And, you know, my dad was a sanitation worker. And I had no business being there. Right. And they would accept suggestions from me for jokes. So like there was one bit where they used to hone in on like a person and give them a caption on SNL.
Does this in the crowd. Yeah. The crowd bits.
Crowd on the audience. Right. So they
like label them. Yeah.
Cute little blonde. And it just, her caption just said, enjoys going down on elevators. And so they're like, oh, that got a laugh. Okay, that's funny, right? So I submit a sketch. And the two big movies of that of that fall, the big Oscar contenders were Raging Bull and Elephant Man. And I submit a sketch, and because I'm a film student at NYU, I write it as a short film. And my boss, the associate producer, is like, no, this is not a sketch. This is a short film. It's got four locations. Frank, how often do we do more than one location for a sketch? And I went, oh, never. Right. So make it one location. So I rewrite it as a boxing ring. And it's, you know, it's Robert De Niro's trainer in Raging Bull is also the John Hurt character, the scientist who finds the deformed character in Elephant Man, right? And so he finds this deformed character, he trains him to be a boxer, and then at the end of it, you know, in Elephant Man, the guy always wore a hood because he was so ugly, right?
Right.
And at the end of the sketch, the line was that they have him in the silk robe that boxers wear with the hood on it. And so they pull down the hood, and there's the other hood from Elephant Man. And he turns to the crowd and he says, I am not an animal. I am a contender. And some of my boss went, yeah, that's funny. That's good. You know, we'll use it next week. Because they were just desperate, you know.
And they did. They used the intern's idea?
They said, yes, we're going to use this intern's idea. And the guest host that week was a woman named Charlene Tilton, who was on a show called Dallas that, again, only people who are a star for entertainment will remember who she is. But the following week was going to be Graham Chapman from Monty Python. And I worshipped Monty Python. They were the gods. Of course. They were the Beatles of comedy for me, right?
Yeah.
And so I'm like, I was 19 then. I was a little older in Ghostbusters. I'm 19. You're going to use my sketch on SNL next week. Holy shit. And I'm calling all my relatives and they're like, hey, as a matter of fact, there's a sketch that's coming on and we need a couple of people to run back and forth in the pandemonium that happens. Why don't you run? And I'm like, wow, my star is really rising here. And so in the sketch, in the show Dallas, they shot J.R., Larry Hagman. And the big mystery was, who shot J.R.? Who shot J.R., right? And so our leading man of SNL was this guy named Charlie Rocket, right? And so in that, they have a scene where they shoot C.R., Charlie Rocket, right? And so the shooting occurs, he falls to the ground, people are running back and forth. But right before that happened, somebody went, Charlie, help, this will help ease the pain. And it was one of the writers backstage, and he hands him two big schnauzers full of cocaine, right? And so Charlie's all kind of hopped up and like, yeah, let's do this, man, right? And he gets out there and he falls and through and pandemonium, and I'm on national TV and, you know, call Aunt Rose in California. And I'm like, this is amazing. And so I get to go back now to the control room. And in the control room is a wall of old cathode ray television sets, right? All in black and white. And it's 16 of them. And it's all the different views of the different cameras and, you know, main camera 1, 2, 3, and 4, right? And at it sits a guy named Davey Wilson. And Davey would talk into the mic and go like, camera 1, zoom in, camera 2. Zoom out, whatever, right? And so that was the last sketch of the night. So Charlie is still hopped up on coke. And the sketch finishes early because there's not enough people to run back and forth. And so they say, Davey Wilson says from the control room to Charlie Rocket, who's on stage for that last scene that you always see on SNL where everybody goes, oh, I had a great time. Good night. What a great show this was. Thanks to the band. Thanks to the Rangers. You know, so he says to Charlie and Joe, he says, Joe, the sketch ran short. We need to ad lib for like 45 seconds more. Can you do that for me? And Joe Piscopo goes, righto, sir. No problem. Right. And so the cameras come up. Now in this room, the control room, there's the bank of TVs. There's one section of chairs, a desk with chairs in it. And that's where the NBC executives got to sit. The second one is where the censor and writers would get to sit. And the third one was for guests. So the only time I'd ever been in the room before that was just where I could stand with my back against the wall. But because everybody thought the show was over, everybody's outside the room saying, like, where are we going to go? Let's party, you know, and trying to pick a restaurant. So Elaine's, we were all going to go to Elaine's after that, right? And so I actually get to sit at the first bank, only where NBC executives can sit. But I sit there because it's just, you know, the last minute of the show. So on screen, Joe Piscopo says to Charlie Rocket, so Charlie, you got shot in the last sketch. Yeah. He says, well, how do you feel about that? He says, well, I'm going to find out who the fuck did it.
This is that famous. Oh, that's when that happened. Huh? I know
that's when that happens.
I know he got tagged for a swear.
Dip. All right. So
okay.
So here's the wall of TVs. Here's the first row, and here's where the censor sits. Is here, right? And so the censor is not at his desk. He's got a big, giant red mushroom button, and all he's got to do is just go bam, and there's a seven second delay. So he's got 7 seconds. Just hit bam. And then 7 seconds of silence will go out over National Broadcasting Corporation's live television, right? And because the censor is out the door already, hitting on some page to try and get her to come to the Elaine's with him, he isn't at his desk to do this. He's outside, but he hears now the word fuck, and he turns and he's like, oh my god, and he starts trying to get around all the people who are talking about, you know, the show and all this stuff, and it's really crowded. He's like wheedling his way through people, and finally he just like pushes somebody out of the way, and he goes flying for the red mushroom button, and it's 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, bam. And he slaps his hand down and misses the button and then goes, bam. So what goes out over the air is Charlie Rocket saying, well, I don't know. And I'm going to find out who the fuck. 7 seconds of silence. So if you're sitting at home and you hear this, you go, dude, did he just say fuck? Yeah, man. He said, fuck. Fuck. And all of America, here's the F word for the first time, I believe. And then 7 seconds of silence to cement it in the minds of all of America.
So you can reflect on it. Yeah.
Yes. And so someone jostles awake the president of NBC. And says, Mr. President, we have a situation. And we all, like a funeral, just kind of hang our heads and walk back into the studio, not Studio 8H, but we had our offices on the 17th floor. And we all kind of walk back in, and we know, like, our goose is cooked. We are screwed. The show has been bad up until now. And this is going to be the final nail in the coffin, right? And so we all have to sit there and wait. And at 2:45 in the morning, the NBC executive comes out of the room with the producer and the associate producer. And it's a glass office. So you can see just like yelling and screaming and, you know, this for like half an hour. And at 2:45 in the morning, Audrey Pert Dickman comes out of her office and says, we are on suspension for 3 weeks. We'd better get our acts together. And we all went, oh, wow, only 3 weeks. Okay, great. Yeah, you know, and the writers are like, okay, we really got to do this, you know. But then before the third week hit, a writer's strike hit. And that ended the season for good. And it just never came back. And those writers never came back. And my sketch never got on the air. And could I have been a famous SNL writer, or comedian or whatever after that, maybe, but you know, the road less traveled is the one that was taken.
Well, I ask this of everybody. It's the worst question of all time. What is your favorite movie of all time?
Well, hopefully I can tell you what I'm up to these days, but my favorite movie of all time would have to be Monty Python's Life of Brian.
Oh, yes. I showed that to my girlfriend who had not seen it. During those extended lockdown movie sessions, you know, when COVID was running, you were indoors. I'm like, sit down. We're watching Life of Brian. And God, what a great movie. I do want to ask what you're working on now. We got about 5 minutes for you to lay out, because LaughMD is behind you. You do virtual film school. I got so many questions for all, because you do so much. Well, and you had for a while there ran Fun Little Movies, which was an ad thing. But tell us about the current things you have going on so people can check them out.
Oh, sure. Great. So LaughMD.com is the one place that I would like people to go, because while SNL was happening, my poor dad passed away in a hospital. And I remember sitting at the hospital with the TV playing, and it was playing some horrible, you know, commercial ridden news show, and thinking, why are they broadcasting all this like bad news into the TVs at the hospital? I wish they could play SNL here 24/7, you know, and laughter is the best medicine, right? And then the same thing happened when my stepfather died. And by this time, television was worse and scarier and all that. And then my youngest brother died in the hospital. And I finally said, look, you guys have got to stop playing this. And, you know, can I please give you, by that time I was running this company, Fun Little Movies, and we had made hundreds of little short comedy films because we were the first channel of comedy videos on Sprint cell phones. And that was cool. I got on the front page of the LA Times. It was fun. And so I had all these films and I was like, hey, hospital, please, here's some videos, put these on instead. And it was a technically very complicated thing to do, but eventually Kaiser Permanente in Hollywood said yes, and they put them on, and everybody loved it. And then Cedars-Sinai said yes, and they put them on, and everybody loved it. And eventually we've been growing this company to now we use an app, and the app is called LaughMD. And no, you can't get it from the App Store yet, because it's only for hospitals and other corporations. But it is something that if you go to our website, laughmd.com, you'll see what we're doing with it. And if you're in the healthcare business and you'd like it, we do two things. We play thousands and thousands of short comedy videos for patients and providers. We've done lots of testing with it. There's 400 studies that show that laughter is good medicine. But in this occasion, it was four studies that we've done, a couple at USC, 91% of the patients at the Norris Cancer Center who had pain, 91% of them said that we lowered their pain. In another study, we showed that we lowered it by half. So it does what you expect it to do. Laughter helps relieve your pain, your stress, lowers your cortisol and your adrenaline, and increases your serotonin, which speed healing, lower the perception of pain. So laughter really does do what you think it does. And we're the first company to ever actually use it as billable, scalable, reimbursable, evidence-based medicine in a medical setting.
That's cool. And yeah, do you have social out there where people can follow, or at least the website?
LaughMD.com or LinkedIn is a good place to contact us through LinkedIn. We have a Facebook page for LaughMD as well. But through LaughMD.com, there's the contact page there.
Right. I'd
love to hear from people who want this or can use it, or especially folks in the medical community who are able to implement this.
And check out themovieguys.net for more interviews with filmmakers, hundreds of podcast episodes, articles, reviews, and more. Frank, thanks a ton. Appreciate it.
Thanks again, Paul.
Bye.